Have you ever heard anyone described as the salt of the earth? We usually use that phrase to describe someone who is dependable, the kind of person you'd trust to care for your children in an emergency, the kind of person who helps maintain the church building without wanting any recognition. I would describe my dad's mother as salt of the earth, the oldest daughter of 12 children, raised on a farm, who helped raise many of her brothers and sisters, completed her college education and teaching credential while raising her own two children, and then went on to teach first grade until she retired. An amazing cook, someone who loved her family deeply, who took her grandchildren to visit her brother's farm regularly, who taught me how to make pie crust. We all know these kinds of people: solid, steady, reliable, trustworthy, the salt of the earth. Did you realize that today's scripture is actually where the phrase salt of the earth originated? The passage that JT just read for us, as Teresa mentioned, is part of the three chapters of Matthew's gospel that we call the Sermon on the Mount. It is perhaps the most widely read and quoted set of chapters in the entire New Testament, filled with familiar passages and references. This sermon happened relatively early in Jesus' ministry, just after he called the first disciples and began preaching in Galilee. It's a sermon that describes what many people believe to be the central principles of the Christian faith. Teresa preached last week on the Beatitudes, the eight phrases describing qualities of an ideal disciple. The Sermon on the Mount also includes the Lord's Prayer, the parable of the wise and foolish builders, the golden rule, and it includes two metaphors for the relationship the disciples are to have with the world, to be salt and light. Before we explore the idea of salt and light more closely, there are a few important things to understand about Matthew's gospel and about the audience who heard the Sermon on the Mount. Each of the four gospels in the New Testament was written by a different author for a different audience with a different purpose at a slightly different time. Matthew's gospel is perhaps the most Jewish of the four gospels. It was believed to have been written between about 70 and 100 CE, or between about 40 and 70 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. Scholars disagree on who actually wrote this gospel. Early church leaders believe it was written by the apostle Matthew, also known as Levi, a tax collector from Capernaum whom Jesus called to follow him. These leaders believe that Matthew collected the sayings of Jesus that appear in the gospel during his ministry and assembled them into a full narrative much later. More recently, some biblical scholars have come to question whether the manuscript was written by the apostle Matthew and believe it was written by an anonymous Jewish Christian who spoke and wrote Greek, mainly because it was written so long after the resurrection. In any case, the gospel was addressed to a community of Jewish Christians who had accepted Jesus as the Messiah, but needed a deeper understanding of the teachings and the importance of his kingdom. These new believers were trying to make sense of the Jewish faith they knew in the context of their belief in Jesus as God's Son and Anointed One. So the purpose of Matthew's gospel was to give hope and guidance to these Jewish Christians who wanted to remain practicing Jews, but were struggling to understand what it meant to be Jewish in the light of this Messiah. They were also living in a socially and politically challenging time. The gospel was written for a people who had lived through more than 100 years of Roman occupation of Jerusalem already, near the time when the Roman army under Emperor Tiberius destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. So the gospel was addressing a community of people living in uncertain and chaotic times. So who was the audience actually listening to Jesus preach this famous Sermon on the Mount? The gospel tells us there was probably a large crowd gathered where he preached. After calling the disciples, Jesus traveled around Galilee, teaching in the synagogues and healing those who were sick. And word of this rabbi who could cure people spread quickly. As Jesus and his disciples traveled around, huge crowds began to follow him everywhere. So on this particular day, as they came to a gentle grassy hillside on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee outside Capernaum, Jesus climbed up the hill and sat down. His disciples followed and gathered around him, and he began to teach. The crowd was there surrounding them, but they were not really the intended audience. As Teresa told us last week, this sermon was really intended to be a close, intimate teaching experience for his most treasured friends and followers, not a public sermon for hundreds or thousands. So more like a small college seminar with 12 students and a professor gathered around in a circle than a large lecture course in a huge hall packed with hundreds of students. And as the teaching began, the disciples were listening closely. They heard Jesus lift up people they did not usually view as blessed. And then imagine a hush falling over the group as Jesus paused, looked each of them in the eye in turn, and declared, "You are the salt of the earth." Let's dig a little deeper into what Jesus meant by that statement. Salt was a familiar element to the disciples. It was a mandatory part of temple sacrifices. It was used to cleanse the temple from negative energy. It was a preservative, a symbol of sacrifice and loyalty. Eating together was referred to as sharing salt, and it was used as a seasoning for foods. So what did Jesus mean when he told disciples they were the salt of the earth? First of all, he was speaking to them as a community, not as individuals. So essentially saying, y'all are the salt of the earth. And in calling them the salt of the earth, he was directing them to live their lives not for themselves, but for the world outside. After all, salt does not exist for itself. Its purpose is to change other things. It brings to life flavors that would otherwise be bland and tasteless. In the same way, Jesus was telling his community of disciples to change the world around them by caring for those who were marginalized. And the way he said it was kind of interesting. He didn't tell them, you should be the salt of the earth, or go be the salt of the earth. He declared it to be so. You are the salt of the earth. Salt is an interesting substance. In the right amount, it blends into foods and brings out their flavor without really being noticed as salt. If the salt is left out of a food completely, the flavors become flat and one-dimensional. And baked goods especially come out dense and tough. But too much salt can also be a problem. It can overwhelm the taste of food. It can lead to health problems like high blood pressure. James and I have some friends who tell a hilarious story of their first experience making a stir fry together as newlyweds. She heated up the pan and added some butter. And because the butter was unsalted, she added a pinch of salt. He had his back turned chopping vegetables. And when the butter was melted, he added them to the pan and salted them. She had been preparing the chicken to go in the pan and topped it off with salt when she added it. While she was out of the room, he realized any good stir fry needed soy sauce, so he added some. And while he was making the rice to go with the stir fry, she thought of soy sauce and added some. When they tasted their food, they were shocked to discover that the salt flavor overwhelmed everything. They tried adding things to dilute the saltiness, some broth, some rice, even some leftover macaroni and cheese. But nothing reduced the salty flavor enough to make the food edible. Ultimately, they made their first shared credit card charge as a married couple to the local pizza delivery place. Salt in the right amount makes a difference. Too much or too little can be a problem. When telling the disciples that they were the salt of the earth, Jesus also recognized that they might forget who they were and what they were called to do. And so he added a warning. If salt was used too sparingly or became contaminated with other elements, it would lose its saltiness, become good for nothing, and have to be thrown out. In the same way, if disciples failed to extend God's love to the world and to care for the least of these, they would be like that tasteless salt and would not enter into the kingdom of heaven at the final judgment. But salt was not the only metaphor Jesus used in this sermon. He also declared that the disciples were the light of the world and reminded them that it was their responsibility not to hide that light, but to let it shine for others. The main purpose of light is to illuminate other things, not to be seen itself, but to allow other things to be visible. In ancient Israel, most people lived in small houses with few windows and obviously with no electricity. At night, people would light their homes with small wicker lamps. Because each lamp only gave out a little light, the most effective way to light the whole house would be to place the lamp in the middle of the room on a lampstand. A lamp placed under a basket would emit very little light at least, and would probably be extinguished. Jesus was instructing the disciples not to hide their light or keep it just for themselves, but to bring that light into a dark world. Like a city on a hill whose light could be seen from miles away, the disciples were to bring the light of the gospel to a dark and broken world by doing good works so others could see them and know of God's justice and mercy. As Anglican Archbishop William Temple once said, "The church is the only organization on earth that exists for those who are not its members." Jesus clearly gave the charge to be salt and light to the disciples gathered around him on the hillside. But how does that charge relate to us today in Lawrenceville in 2026? Remember, Jesus was addressing the disciples as a community, not as individuals. How can we, as a community of believers who follow Jesus, be the salt that enriches the world around us and prepares others to hear and believe the good news? How can we be the light for the world, not so that others see us, but so that everyone sees God's love illuminated by our love? Living our lives as salt and light can be challenging. As Reverend Derek Penwell, minister at Douglas Boulevard Christian Church in Louisville, wrote, quote, "Salt and light aren't self-esteem slogans, but material metaphors for costly love your neighbor care that can't stay hidden," end quote. We are charged not just to stay home and pray for things to get better, but to go into the dark places of our world, bearing the light of Christ. We must engage and walk through the darkness of our world so that in time we can overcome it. So what does that look like in our everyday lives? If we are salt and light, we are putting ourselves out into the midst of people who need us, embodying God's love for and with them. This might look like cooking meals for people recovering from disasters and bringing warm clothes to people living outdoors during an ice storm. It might be helping job seekers get professional clothing for interviews and providing haircuts for people in need. In North Carolina, professional chef Matthew Kuntz volunteered with Second Harvest Food Bank in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene last year. He and other volunteers spent a week cooking ready-to-heat meals, which were transported to storm-damaged areas to feed residents and emergency workers. As a team, they cooked about 7,000 meals in just a week's time. In Athens, students leading an organization called Campus Kitchen reduce food waste and feed hungry people by collecting leftover food from local restaurants and grocery stores, using that food to cook packaged meals, and distributing the meals to seniors in the community without enough to eat. In Atlanta, the nonprofit The Heart of Haircuts builds people's dignity by providing fresh haircuts to those in need and by training young people to become barbers. These are only a few examples of how groups of people are being salt and light by giving themselves away completely. Not in the kind of service that wins us medals or gets us recognition on TV or makes our social media posts go viral, but in the kind of quiet service that meets basic needs and gives people hope and dignity. In 1951, J. Malloy Roach and George Michaels wrote a simple song called One Little Candle, which was later sung by artists including Perry Como, Anita Bryant, and the group Chicago. I learned this song in summer camp as a girl, and it has always stuck with me. It is better to light just one little candle than to stumble in the dark. Better far that you light just one little candle. All you need is a tiny spark. If we'd all say a prayer that the world would be free, the bright, shiny dawn of a new day we'd see. So if everyone lit just one little candle, what a bright world this would be. Just as salt disappears into food to make it tastier, we are called to transform the world by disappearing in humble service to others. Just as light fills the space and illuminates everything around it, we are called to be light for others through our acts of love, mercy, and justice. For as Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reminds us, darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. And author William Shakespeare said in The Merchant of Venice, how far that little candle throws his beams, so shines a good deed in a weary world. Let us go out as a community that believes deeply in the love of God through Christ and share that love as salt and light to the world. Amen.